trace it. I wasn't sure how it all worked, but I knew that there were records, little cards that the telephone operators were responsible for, and that logged who had placed what call and where and for how long. There could be no evidence of this next one, not if my plan was to work. As I walked, my steps steady and sure, I hoped that it would, that the plan I had conjured up out of despair and desperation only moments earlier would be enough. I had not anticipated this, after all, had not foreseen this turn, and it stung, this change in the narrative that I had not consented to. I had already worked it out so perfectly, and she had gone and erased it all. The public telephone box sat at the end of the street, just as I remembered. Once inside, I waited to hear the click, waited for the greeting of the operator before I began to speak, my accent molded in some proximity after Alice's own. "I'd like to be connected to the local police, please." I paused. "Yes, yes, I'll wait. My name? Alice Shipley." It was done. There was no turning back. I hung up the telephone, my thoughts distorted. Everything had shifted in the course of an hour. It seemed impossible, ridiculous even, that an entire life could be altered by a few brief words. My mind tried and failed to keep up with it, to understand the consequences of what I had just set in motion. But then, no, I reminded myself, it had not been me, it had been Alice. She had been the one. I turned to exit the telephone booth, but a figure stood there, blocking me. "Yosef. Oh, please just leave me alone," I murmured, suddenly aware of the sweltering temperature of the little glass booth. My blouse clung to my back. "We have nothing to say to one another." He smiled.
"But I only wish to speak, to try and make things right between us once more."
I looked at him, knowing that he did not mean what he said, knowing that there was something else, another reason for his visit today, for his visit the other night. Our encounters were not merely coincidences, I knew. There was something that he wanted from me. No, it was more than that. Something he thought he could get, perhaps deserved, was owed. I wondered what it could be, how it could ever matter in light of what had happened already. The police would arrive soon. I had little time left, which meant I needed to return to the flat. But I paused, wanting a few more minutes, a few more hours in which I could pretend that everything was just as it had been the day before. And so, even though I knew that it was not the smartest decision, that I should shoo away the mosquito before me and continue with what I needed to get done, I leaned heavily against the frame of the booth and consented. "I suppose," I said, ignoring even as I did so the dangerous smile on his face. Pushing aside the venomous words that he had spoken to me that night in the street, I followed him to Café Hoppe and beyond, through one of the numerous unmarked doors that signaled the dwellings of the local community. I even agreed to the ridiculous proposition that he eventually put forth, a request for a portrait. Wanting, needing to know in that instance just what it was that lurked behind his smile, both tired and angry that he was the second person in my life who had decided to try and put something over on me that day. Once inside, I noted the dozen or so canvases lining the room, and moving silently among them, I wondered whether any of the work actually belonged to Yosef, or if those too were part of his facade. Perhaps the paints and brushes were just props on a stage. The canvases completed by another hand, that daughter that either John or Alice had once mentioned, though I could no longer recall who had spoken the words. The paintings themselves were adequate, if unremarkable. A sunset, an ocean, the market on a busy day. Everyday life in Tangier, I noted, though the colors were bright and cheerful, dispelling the notion that anything untoward ever ran through the veins of the city. All trace of filth, of grime swept away. I was struck with a sudden desire to laugh. There was one, though, that caused me to pause. It was a series of rooftops, nothing remarkable, but the vibrancy of the paint struck me. Perhaps it was the broad, careless strokes or the clashing colors. Clotheslines I could decipher, a tenuous link that held each building together, a jumbled mess that made it impossible to pick out where one began and the other ended. It was horrible, in some ways, going against everything they taught you in class. And yet there was something else there as well, something that reminded me of Tangier, as if I were already gone. Whatever it was, I slowed, my fingers resting lightly on the frame. "This one is beautiful," I said. Yosef nodded, directing me toward a stool that he had set in the center of the room, a beam of natural light illuminating the space, his easel and canvas only a few paces away. "Please," he said. I sat, grateful for his suggestion, for the opportunity to let my mind relax, to wander, to not dwell on all that had happened over the last few days, on all the things that would have to happen still. My eyes began to flutter in the calmness of the room. I felt the warmth of the sun against my face, and I sighed, my body relaxing.
"You know,"
Yosef said, his voice cutting through the air,
"I saw you."
I frowned, my mind still slow from the heat. I had not expected him to begin so quickly. "You saw me?" I repeated, opening my eyes to look at him. His face emerged from behind the canvas, his eyes strangely bright.
"Yes, I saw you the other day, by the tombs."
I stopped. My hand twitched in my lap, but I stilled them. "With my friend, you mean?" I replied, working to keep my voice light, breathy, though I was awake now. "Yes, I took her up to Cafe Haffa. I thought she would enjoy the view."
"Yes?"
he nodded.
"I saw that, too."
Ah, so here was the truth of it at last. He had been following me, tailing me like some heroic detective in a third-rate film. It seemed I had not given Yosef enough thought. He had faded into the background, a mosquito to be flicked away. But now thinking about it, recalling his expression when I had brushed him aside that night. Irritation, yes, but something more as well. I felt his buzzing return. Anger. That's what it had been. An anger that ran wide and deep, and that was, I knew, directed at far more than just myself. My mind raced. If he had been following me, that would mean... My breath caught in my throat. He knew. I realized... He knew, and he had decided that he would try to trap me with it.
"Yes,"
he continued, speaking slowly with confidence, with ease, confirming my suspicions.
"I saw you with him."
And then, just so there was no misunderstanding between us, he added,
"I saw what you did."
I did not move. "I have money," I said evenly, as though it were not a great thing, but thinking, even as I said it, of my nearly depleted account. Yosef nodded, though his face was twisted as if insulted by my words, even though they were the ones he had wished me to speak. I thought that I understood his disgust, his hatred, and I was willing to forgive him in light of his situation, willing to overlook the fact that he had just attempted this con on me, his sole supporter and defender. After all, I understood desperation, understood what it could do to you, what it could force you to do in return. We were, Yosef and I, not so dissimilar from one another. But then I thought of the money. I clasped my hands together tightly, feeling the pain as my nails dug into flesh. I ignored it, ignored the bright red blood that rose from my skin. One payment would not be enough. No amount of money would ever be enough, I suspected. No, I needed a way out. And then I remembered. The first time we had met, all those days ago now, outside of Cinema Riff, Yosef thought my name was Alice. It hadn't been a conscious decision when I had first arrived in Tangier and given him her name instead of my own. It had only been a hesitation, and uncertainty about the man before me. He was someone used to wearing masks, and so I had, as I had done many times before, adopted my own. There had been nothing beyond that initial instinct. But now I could see the advantages. I hated to do it, felt my whole body rebel at the thought. But then I reminded myself there was nothing else to be done. I had been trapped, backed into a corner, and the only thing that mattered any longer was survival, my own survival. They had, Alice and Yusuf both, left me no other choice.
Chapter 13. Alice. After the telephone call with Aunt Maud, I felt relieved, buoyed even, knowing that she would soon be in Tangier, that she would set things right. And yet as I stood in the living room, as I took in each and every little item that had belonged to John, I felt consumed by guilt for the thoughts that I had entertained only hours before, wondering whether I wanted to remain in Tangier, remain with him. It felt like a betrayal, and one far more dangerous than anything he had committed. I left the flat then, desperate to be away from the tight enclosure that was filled with him, walking down one street and then another, passing by the market that we had once gone to together, ignoring the overpowering smell of leather, of meat, though it threatened to turn my stomach. I passed by a cafe I recognized from our early days, where we had sat and laughed together. As I increased my pace, tripping over my own feet as I hurried, with no real direction, no real purpose, I realized that each and every corner of this city was marked by my memories of John. It did not matter where I went. There was no escaping them. At some point, I became aware of being watched. He was smart, kept himself well hidden, so that I saw him first only out of the corner of my eye, the wide brim of his hat obscuring his face. I had shaken my head, had told myself sternly to stop imagining things. But then, there he was again, the same man from earlier that morning, the one with the scar. He was just to the side of me, first to the right, then to the left, sometimes a few paces ahead, careful never to let me see him, not entirely. He was smart. But then, I reminded myself, if he worked with John for the government, I supposed he had to be. I felt my heart begin to beat faster, wondering what it was that he wanted, what answers he could possibly think I held. I increased my speed, turned down one alley and then another, but it did not matter. I could not manage to lose him. By the time I returned to the flat, I was out of breath, my heart beating hard and fast, my hands shaking as I fumbled with the lock. At some point my hair had fallen from its clasp, and I could feel the strands as I made my way to the sitting room, tickling round the edges of my face, so that I brushed them away, quickly, intently, trying to free myself from their maddening touch. I came to a sudden stop. Lucy was there, sitting on the sofa, but she was not alone. Two policemen stood on either side of her, clothed in the familiar tan uniform and peculiar hat, the one that sat on top of, rather than on, their head. Their rifles, I noticed, were balanced against one of the bookshelves. I blinked, wondering if they were truly there, wondering whether I had only imagined them.
"Alice," Lucy began, her voice filled with concern. "The police have come to ask about John, about his disappearance. They wanted to speak with you, but I told them I wasn't sure where you were. At the market, I supposed."
I must look mad, I realized, clutching at the bookcase beside me, desperate in that moment to feel something real beneath my fingers. "I'm sorry," I murmured, not knowing to whom I had even addressed the apology. One of the policemen stood.
"Est-ce que tout va bien, madame?"
"Oui," I struggled to answer. My breath, I noticed, was short and raspy.
"Elle a l'air malade,"
the other policeman observed. He made as if to start toward me, but I held up my hand. "Non," I declared firmly. "I'm not ill." There was a silence, during which the policemen both eyed me with something that was not quite concern.
"We received your telephone call, Madame Shipley,"
one of them eventually said. "Telephone call?" I looked around the room at the expectant faces watching me. "But I didn't ring anyone." The same officer frowned, consulting the notebook he held between his hands.
"We were informed earlier this morning by a Madame Alice Shipley that her husband was missing."
He paused.
"That is not you?"
"No," I said, my gaze sliding over to where Lucy sat, wondering how long the policeman had been there and just what she might have said to them in the interval. My thoughts flickered to the man with the scar then, and his insistence that the local police not be contacted.
"So your husband isn't missing?"
"What?" I asked, turning my attention back to the officer. "No, I mean, yes, yes, he is."
"Your husband is missing, but you didn't call to report him?"
I nodded, cheeks blushing. "Yes, yes, that's right." There was a silence as both the officers frowned, and then Lucy said, "I was thinking," sounding as though she were resuming a conversation that I had interrupted with my entrance. Her eyes scanned the room, resting eventually on me. It was only for a fraction of a second, one, two, three, I didn't know how long exactly, but I could see already what it was that she was doing. I knew her as well as I knew myself, knew the way her mouth curved into an O when she was embarrassed, knew the sound she made when startled, or the way her pupils dilated when she was pleased. I knew her, and I knew in that instant that whatever thoughts were turning in her mind, they had arrived upon some sort of conclusion when she had glanced my way.
"There was a man," she said. "Yusuf."
I frowned, feeling something begin to prickle at the back of my neck.
"Yusuf?"
The policeman paused, scrolling through his notepad.
"Who is this?"
Lucy shrugged.
"He's just a local. A grifter, really. He also goes by the name of Joseph."
She shook her head as if to clear her thoughts. "I don't even know why I mentioned him." It was a lie, I thought. She turned to me.
"I think Alice knew him. I seem to remember her mentioning him when I first moved here. I always thought it was strange that she would know someone like him. But now I realize that Tangier is a small city. It's quite easy to know everyone."
She stopped and then added,
"He wears a fedora with a purple ribbon. That's how most people know him. He never goes anywhere without it."
There was no accusation in her voice. She was smarter than that. But the policeman, I could see the light behind his eyes flash, just dimly, but enough such that I knew his interest had been piqued. I could see it in the way his body seemed to expand, to fill the room. I could also see what she had done, made a connection, a link between Yusuf and myself, a trail, scattering the breadcrumbs.
"Merci beaucoup,"
the officer said, making a slight nod with his head.
"We will look into this and let you know whether anything more has been found. Chances are he is where most Tangerines end up, drunk somewhere, sleeping it off, or..."
He let his words trail.
"Or what?"
I asked, my voice not quite the challenge I intended. He only shrugged.
"In the meantime, madame, let us know if you hear from your husband."
I nodded, ignoring the way the words sounded like a reprimand, as if I were the one to blame for John's disappearance. I tried to think of the other reasons he had left unspoken. A fight with a local gambler gone wrong? A stabbing, perhaps? A disagreement at one of the nightclubs with one of the men in charge of the women there? I shook my head. They were wrong. But before I could tell them, they were gone, a jostling of thick fabric and heavy boots.
"Where have you been?"
Lucy asked, her voice cutting through the silence. I watched as she stood from the sofa, as she moved to perch on the ledge of the window. She was dressed in dark trousers and a plain light blouse, and I was struck with the thought, this is her, watching as she brought a lit cigarette to her mouth. The long, elegant lines, the absence of frills and bows. She was still the most beautiful woman that I had ever met, but in a way that made me shiver with fear. It's so dark, I observed, realizing that the sun had begun to set, that the room had fallen into darkness since the departure of the police. I moved toward one of the lamps, desperate suddenly for the light.
Don't, she instructed, her voice firm, resolute. I want to watch the sunset.
There was a challenge there, and I fought the urge to disregard her words, to flip the switch anyway, so that it would send us both, momentarily blind, into the light. I thought of Aunt Maud, now on her way to Tangier, and my fingers twitched again, eager for the moment she arrived.
It's unlike anything at home, isn't it?
She asked then, not bothering to turn her head toward me. I looked out of the window, the sky awash with stripes of pink and white and blue. Yes, it was different, I thought, maybe even beautiful. But at that moment I saw only something ominous and warning, a threat that I could never quite manage to elude. I had promised my aunt that I would not involve the police, and yet somehow they had turned up on my doorstep. And even though I was certain that I had not called them, that I had not been the one to summon them, my mind sought and failed to remember those moments after I had hung up the telephone with Maud with any sort of precision. I had been overwrought, surrounded by this place that was entirely John's, the apartment and the city belonging to him in a way that I could not understand. I would have given anything in that moment to return to the dark, rainy skies of my childhood. She turned to me.
You never go out.
There was no accusation in her voice. She spoke as one did when reciting facts. And it was a fact, I thought. Once I had never gone out. Once I had been so afraid of what might lurk in the corners of the alleyways, in the back rooms of bars and cafes. But that was before, I wanted to tell her. Before she had arrived, before John had disappeared, before everything had changed, and I had begun to suspect, begun to remember, that the true danger did not lie entirely within my own mind.
Where did you go? She asked.
I watched the plume of her cigarette smoke as it crowded her features, and I wondered whether she might know, and whether it was possible that she was asking only in order to see if I would be truthful.
To the market, I lied.
She looked around the flat.
And what did you buy?
Nothing. I shrugged, although I was unable to determine whether she could see the gesture in the darkness that shrouded us. I only wanted to look.
It's quite late for the market.
My voice was too insistent as I replied. I went there first and then out for a walk. She nodded, and then said, her eyes boring into my own,
I was surprised that you didn't tell me. About John's disappearance, I mean.
I held her gaze, and though my voice trembled, I asked, Did I need to? The question, the implication, hung between us, unanswered. She turned to the window and said,
We could still leave, you know.
The two of us, together. We could go to Spain, to Paris. She paused, turning to look at me slowly, so that I could hear the rustle of her trousers as she moved.
It's not too late. This doesn't have to be the end.
I could see it, the desperation glinting in her eyes. And part of me, though I knew it was absurd, that it was wrong, wanted to say yes. It would be easier to close my eyes and give in, to close the distance between us and leave this nightmare behind. And perhaps she sensed it too, this relenting, for she reached out, as if to touch me. But then I thought of Tom, of John, of what she had most likely— No, I whispered fiercely to myself, had absolutely done, and I felt myself pale. I knocked her hand away with a force that surprised us both. I could see it. The shock, the disappointment, and yes, the anger.
You can't blackmail me into loving you, Lucy, I spat, unable to stop myself. It doesn't work like that.
Her face froze, so that it seemed as though her features were contracting, shrinking. And then, through the darkness, I saw the start of a smile beginning at one corner of her mouth. It seemed like her lips were tilted, jerked upward, the look of a cat toying with a mouse. My skin began to itch, knowing that something was about to happen, sensing already the danger in her next words.
When will you tell the police?
She asked. I grew still.
About what you know?
What do I know?
I whispered, trying to ignore the trembling of my body. A smile now, a real, genuine one that could not be hidden.
About Sabine.
I placed my arms around my waist. I did not want to be there any longer. Not in that room, not in Tangier, not anywhere on the continent of Africa. It was not my home. It had never been my home. All I had done was create an enclosure that I had trapped myself within. I had created the lock, and I had given Lucy the key. My stomach lurched, and I thought for a moment that I would be sick, there, in the living room, surrounded by John's things and Lucy's Cheshire grin.
Sabine?
I repeated.
Yes.
She turned.
The police will want to know about what happened that day, at Café Haffa.
I could feel it then, could feel myself contracting, could feel myself stalling in terror. No, not terror. Horror. I remembered that day, the woman, the shattered glass, the blood on the stairs glistening underneath the afternoon sun. The conviction that she was somehow familiar, though I could not place her. But then, of course I could. The image of her face from that first night, those seconds before I had fainted, the truth of John, of our relationship, laid bare. I could not move, could not speak. I stood there frozen.
What are you talking about, Lucy?
She let out a small laugh.
Alice, I know you pushed her.
I could feel my blood rushing, could hear the noise whooshing through my ears, pulsing against my eardrums.
I didn't, Lucy. I didn't push that woman.
You mean Sabine? She asked.
My stomach dropped at the mention of her name, but I forced the panic down. I had puzzled over that day already, wondering at what had happened a dozen or so times, never arriving at any explanation. I had seen it play out in my mind, over and over, sometimes imagining that I saw her face in the moments before she fell. The look of terror that shrouded her features, knowing what was happening and unable to stop it. Had I relished it, I wondered, trying to conjure up that feeling again, knowing somehow that I had realized who she was even then. I looked at Lucy and I fought for words that would not come.
I don't blame you, Alice, she said, moving away from the window. I would have done the same. After all, when someone betrays you like that,
she said, letting her words trail, her eyes glowing in the darkness. I felt my pulse quicken, felt the shadows in the corners begin to grow.
I'm headed to bed now,
I said, feeling my voice as it reverberated throughout my body.
I'm afraid I have a terrible headache.
That night, I locked the door to my bedroom. I pushed and pulled the heavy wooden dresser from its regular place beside the door, listening with satisfaction as its wooden legs scraped and scratched at the floorboards beneath, thinking about the absurdity of the situation, of the circularity of the whole wretched thing. It took me the better part of an hour, pushing and pulling, but I did not stop, not until at last it formed a barrier, a divide between my room and the hallway, between Lucy and myself. I looked down. Deep rivulets were now carved into the floorboards beneath. I was glad for the marks, for the permanency of my actions, a record of my resistance. I would show them to Aunt Maud when she arrived, so that she could see everything I had done in order to free myself from Lucy's grasp. she would understand then, and together we would find a way out.
Chapter 14. Lucy. I waited several days before returning to the place where I had hidden his body, making the journey as much to reassure myself that it was real, that it had happened, that John was well and truly dead, and would not somehow reappear, a specter sent to haunt me, as to ensure that Yosef had not meddled with it in the meantime. I waited until Alice was asleep, until the city at last began to doze, before moving quickly through the darkness. My head full, my ears ringing, the humidity seemed to rise with each and every step, ones that brought me inevitably closer to him. And yet, despite knowing that I would find him where I had last left him, his body wedged beneath a boulder so near the cliff's edge that not even the locals dared to stray, it was still a shock to see him, the visceral evidence of my anger. I tilted my head. Under the fractured moonlight, he could almost be mistaken for a tourist sleeping peacefully under the Tangier moon. After it had happened, time had swept by curiously fast, so that I had found myself unusually unsettled, panicked as I strove to move him, his body, toward my intended hiding place, a spot that had once seemed perfect, but in that moment felt too far away, too exposed. I stood looking down at him, my former opponent now defeated, now vanquished. He posed a threat no longer. The ringing in my ears began to ease, and the feeling of fullness began to dissipate. As if with my previous thought went all the worry, the anxiety that had plagued me since my arrival in Tangier. I moved closer, and averting my face began to pull, trying now to unwedge what I had so determinedly wedged only a few days before. I gave him a hard shove, his body already rigid, putrid. My eyes resisted gazing at his skull, at the hollow I imagined there, from the rock that I had hidden behind my back that night. Its edges sharp, filled with intention. It had made a dull thud when it landed on the crown of his head, the movement itself forcing me to reach up, up and up and up, it seemed, beyond my natural height, so that I had wrenched my shoulder in the process, so that afterward I had reared back, unsteady, worried I had just given him the upper hand. But no, he had already fallen to his knees. In surprise, in hurt, I didn't know, couldn't recall, that insistent buzzing had by then grown to deafening heights, so that even if he had said something, anything, I most likely wouldn't have heard it at all. His last words, if there were any, were lost. Only Tangier knew, and I suspected she would keep her secrets. Afterward, I had looked at the rock in my hand, at the cold mass smeared in blood, and wondered whether it was a rock at all, or a piece of tomb that had once housed the dead. I had been forced to suppress a laugh. John had stirred then, his face contorting with rage at the realization of what was happening, the ferocity of his emotions somehow managing to knock us both to the ground so that the rock slipped from my hand. Perhaps he did speak then, my memory suggested. A couple of short declarative sentences, nothing worth remembering. His speech had been slurred as if he had had too much to drink. He had taken the rock, holding it high above his head so that he looked like some grotesque version of a dancer trying to execute a pirouette. He had started to move toward me, unsteady, the gash on his forehead bleeding heavily, streaming down the side of his face, cloaking him in a slick darkness. It happened quickly then. I was up, prying the rock from his fingers. He offered little resistance, as if realizing the futility of it. I brought the rock down hard this time, and he did not stir again. Pushing his body now, my arms shaking with the effort, I wondered at what it had all been for. I stopped at the cliff's edge. We had come to the end. Leaning down, I gave one final push, the strain, the effort running through each and every part of my body, every sinewy muscle as if it were required, necessary in absolution of my crime. I stood still, covered in dirt and grime, listening for the splash below, waiting to hear the heralding of the end. There was nothing. Afterward, I stood, standing on the edge of the cliff, looking out at the ocean below, trying to read my future. Alice would not be coming with me, I knew. We would not be traveling to Spain, would not be eating tapas or drinking wine under the setting sun. Paris, I realized dully, would never happen. I saw clearly, for perhaps the first time, that the life that I had envisioned for us would never come to pass. And what was more, I saw why. It was Alice. She was the one who had run away to Tangier, who had left me alone and broken in the cold streets of New York. It was her choices, her decisions that had led us here. The only thing I had done, that I had ever done, was try to do what was best for us, to create the life that she had claimed to want. Only she hadn't wanted it. Not really. I thought back to her words the other night at the bar, and the realization hit full and hard, so that I heard the ringing, tasted the coppery metallic tang of it, the truth in my mouth. She had never wanted me. I turned away from the ocean, from what I had done. I was not one for last rites, and I knew there was nothing to say that would be honest and good. The most I could muster as I walked away from the breaking light of morning was that he was with a woman he had loved for better or for worse, and whatever that love had meant to him, he would be with her, Tangier, for the rest of time. In that, John was the luckiest one among us.
Chapter 15. Alice. I arrived at the door, out of breath. That morning had been spent at the bank, trying to withdraw what money was left in the account that I had shared with John before it was time to leave Tangier for good. I had been dismayed at first to find out just how much John had run through, the number causing me to start in confusion as I puzzled over what he had done with the allowance that Aunt Maud had wired each month. At first I thought of Sabine, had wondered whether she had been another beneficiary who had profited from my parents' trust. The idea had made me ill, but then I remembered the sight of her face, about what Lucy had claimed, before she had fallen, so young, so frightened, and I no longer worried about how much she may or may not have received. I turned the key into the lock, moving quickly, wanting to make sure the flat was tidy before Aunt Maud arrived. I had received a telegram from her only the day before, and though I had planned to meet her at the dock, I had been met with a firm refusal, Maud insisting that I needn't trouble myself, that a taxi would be suitable, and she would meet me at the flat. I only hoped that Lucy would be out. We had fallen into a pattern over the last several days. Lucy rose early, disappearing for most of the afternoon, returning only after I had already secured myself behind my locked bedroom door each night. I had worried at first, wondering whether I should be wary, whether I should be concerned that she did not seek my company as she once had, but rather seemed to run from it, anxious to pass the day away from me. It was strange, and so unlike her. But I had decided in the end that my time would be better spent cleaning, packing, preparing myself for my aunt's arrival and my ensuing exodus from Tangier, for the moment when I would no longer have to concern myself with Lucy Mason ever again. I stepped into the hallway and stopped. There were voices coming from the living room, a bit of laughter and then a rushed word or two spoken in a tenor that I recognized as belonging to Aunt Maud. My stomach lurched as I moved quickly, wondering how on earth Lucy had known, wondering too what she had done, what she had said, to make Aunt Maud laugh like that, a sound I could not remember hearing in all the years I had known her. They sat together on the sofa, the two of them, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, a tray of tea and biscuits before them. "What's going on?" I demanded.
Aunt Maud looked up, startled.
Alice, there you are.
She stood, crossed the distance between us, and gave me a brief perfunctory hug.
I was early, but Sophie was here to let me in.
She frowned at my expression, which was, I knew, frozen in fear, in terror, at finding Maud here with her and all the implications that hung around that one simple fact.
Alice, what's happened? You've gone pale.
She began to step toward me, saying,
The police have told you, then.
I looked at Lucy, sitting there, perched on the edge of the sofa. She was, I noticed, wearing that same black-belted dress she had first arrived in. Her disguise, I realized now.
That's not Sophie Turner,
I replied, ignoring my aunt's question. Maud frowned.
What on earth are you talking about?
She turned around toward Lucy.
Do you have any idea?
Lucy's face collapsed with concern.
I think perhaps it's the stress of the situation. As I said on the telephone, she hasn't been herself since John's disappearance.
She's lying, I snapped, so that Maud turned to me in surprise. Everything Lucy says is a lie. It always has been.
Alice, Maud began quietly, I think you're confused, dear. I think you're mixing up what happened with John with what happened before, with Tom.
No, no, I'm not,
I said, shaking my head.
Yes, dear,
she replied, her hands clutching at her throat, that same gesture of worry, the one trait that we shared, the one visible proof that the same blood ran through our veins.
You told me yourself about Sophie staying with you only a few days ago. Don't you remember?
I shook my head, unable in that moment to find a way out of my own lies. And then I remembered her earlier words.
Have the police told me what?
I asked. She stopped, confusion sweeping her features.
I assumed that was why you looked so upset, that you had just come from the police.
What's happened?
I demanded. Lucy stood.
Alice, the police were here earlier. I've told your aunt what they came to see you about. A group of fishermen found him, down by the port. John, I mean.
She paused, her face a picture of concern. They've been looking for you.
For me?
I asked.
Yes, Alice, Maud replied. They need you to identify him.
I had been right then. John was dead,
just as Tom was dead. I crossed the distance between us in only a few short steps, ignoring the shock on my aunt's face, the amused surprise on Lucy's own. I grabbed at her handbag, tearing it away from her.
Alice, Maud cried, what are you doing?
I ignored her, rummaging through the bag, searching for what had to be there, knowing that not even she could have foreseen this.
Her passport,
I said, my hand grasping onto the small booklet at last. I tossed the handbag aside, watching Lucy flinch as it clattered onto the ground, a silver compact landing face down, its powder crumbling, covering the tiled floor.
Here,
I said, thrusting the booklet toward my aunt. My hand faltered, though only for a moment, remembering as I did so the incidents at Bennington with the bracelet, with the photographs. I brushed away a stray piece of hair that clung stubbornly to the sweat on my forehead. It did not matter, I reminded myself. That was a different time, a different circumstance. Back then Lucy had planned it, plotted each and every step, so that there was nothing I could do but fall into the trap she had set for me. Now she was only acting on instinct. She was reacting to my refusal to yield, the denial of which had caught her off guard, unaware. I could see it, written plainly across her face.
Open it, I commanded my aunt. Open it and you'll see she's lying. You'll see that she's not Sophie Turner, that she's someone else entirely.
And who is that? Maud demanded.
I've already told you,
I said, my voice pleading.
Lucy Mason!
She let out a noise of frustration.
Oh, Alice. She shook her head. How are we back here again?
No, I said, refusing to listen. You'll see, this time you'll see that I'm right. Just open it.
Aunt Maud sighed, holding the bundle between her fingers as though she dreaded to open them, dreaded even to touch them. But why, I wanted to shout, why, when they would prove her niece right, when they would cast suspicion and doubt onto the woman, the stranger, sitting beside her, instead of on her flesh and blood?
Auntie, please, I whispered, hating her in that moment for forcing me to ask her to choose her own niece.
Very well,
she sighed, opening the pages. I waited. For the frown of confusion, the inevitable anger, once Maud realized she, too, had been taken in by the seemingly innocuous girl sitting on the sofa before us. And yes, there it was. I smiled in relief, watching as a frown stole over her features, the lines between her eyes folding, deepening. I watched as she handed Lucy the papers, wanting, I knew, an explanation. My body arched toward them, eager to hear the excuses that Lucy would produce, knowing that there was nothing she could say, nothing that would save her this time. But then Lucy was placing the papers into the pocket of her dress, and Maud was settling back onto the sofa.
"What's happened?" I demanded. "What has she done?"
Maud shook her head, as though disappointed.
"Sophie hasn't done anything, Alice."
I struggled to breathe.
Why are you still calling her that?
I shook my head, trying to understand.
You saw her passport, you just looked at it.
Maud nodded.
Yes, Alice, I did.
I looked from Maud to Lucy and back again. The two of them, the pair of them, sat gazing up at me, their faces steely and hard. It struck me then just how similar they were. Strong and sometimes distant, hard and oftentimes unyielding. I wondered how I had never seen it before. And then the thought flickered across my mind, even though I knew it was nonsense, that it was a thought of desperation, of madness, and yet still, looking at them together, I wondered whether it was possible, whether they were in on it together. If this, all of this, wasn't for the sole purpose of driving me mad, of putting me away forever. It would make Lucy glad to know that I would never belong to another, that locked away no one would ever touch me. And Maud? I thought of the trust that would be mine within a short time, of her role as my guardian. It was insane, it was madness, and yet I could not help but think that it all made sense.
"Why are you doing this?"
I whispered, my voice cold and still.
"Doing what?" Aunt Maud asked.
"This,"
I said, willing my voice to remain steady, calm.
"What was on that passport?"
I demanded, realizing that I had not seen it myself, had not seen the words written beside the photograph. Maud watched me coolly.
"What do you think was on it, Alice?"
I wasn't sure if it was the way she looked at me, detached, as though we were no longer bound together by blood, or her voice, low and challenging, and which in that moment I could only read as a threat. Or perhaps it was the simple realization that the one woman I had always trusted, the only real family I had left, had abandoned me, betrayed me. The knowledge of that threatened to smother me, such that I let out a strange, demented cry as I lunged toward Lucy once more, this time toward the pages in her pocket. I had to know, I told myself, pushing away her hands that she held up in self-defense, my nails sinking into her flesh. I had to know what was on the passport, whether my aunt simply did not believe me, or whether she was working with her, with Lucy, whether it was my best interest or my fortune that she had on her mind. And so I pushed and pulled, I scratched until I felt the blood, her blood, beneath my fingernails. I did everything I could until I tasted copper, until I felt two powerful arms pull me away.
"Alice!"
Maud was crying, her face drained of color. I stopped. I looked up into my aunt's face, into the fear that flooded her features,
Her hair had started to come undone, strands of it falling down her face. I turned toward Lucy and saw that she looked equally affected, her pinned hair now falling around her shoulders, her dress askew, her stockings torn, the evidence of my violence written there across her body. An apology rose on my lips, but I stopped, feeling the weight of her papers between my hands. I had to know. And so I cast a hurried glance at the words written on the passport now grasped between my fingers. Sophie Turner. I struggled to breathe. She was, I realized with a sinking feeling, still one step ahead.
Chapter 16. Lucy. It was easy enough to convince Maud Shipley that her niece was going mad. After that initial telephone call, we had spoken a handful of times before her arrival in Tangier, and I had reported on her niece's movements, her state of mind, remembering all the while the words that Alice had once spoken to me, about the fear after her parents' death that her aunt had wanted to commit her, the fear that her aunt thought she was mad, the fear that she might just be right. Alice's episode that afternoon had only helped. I had almost pitied her, watching how confident she had been, convinced that she was about to best me. Standing before us, her eyes wide, dazed, her fingers turning the same pages of the passport back and forth, over and over, as if it would somehow change what was printed there. I had been half tempted to rush to her, to take her in my arms and forgive her for everything that she had done. Instead, I had looked away, brushed the instinct aside. She couldn't have known that I had already switched passports, that the idea had come to me while sitting in Yosef's studio the day he had tried to blackmail me. I had sat still in the moments afterward, afraid to move, to betray any indication of weakness. Only when I had worked it all out in my mind, at last did I allow myself to smile, to shift. And then, steeling myself for his response, I had said, "Before I give you the money, I need you to do something for me first." Yosef's eyes had narrowed, surprised, no doubt, by the audacity of my request. I held his gaze. "I need a new passport."
"And why would I do that?" He laughed. "So that you can disappear without paying me?"
"You'll be paid, and in advance. But if I don't get new papers, well, what would be the point of paying you to keep quiet? The police will figure it out sooner or later, and if not from you, then from Alice. New papers are my only way out of Tangier. Otherwise, I might as well spend my money on enjoying my final hours." I held my smile, though I could feel it shaking against my teeth. Yosef paused, considering my words. I could see him weighing them carefully, as I had known he would. After all, what did he care if I left Tangier as long as he got something first? Yes, he would have preferred a longer con, one that continued to earn him something over time, but if forced to choose between nothing and something, he was smart, and I knew where he would fall.
"All right," he conceded. "I know a man who might be able to help."
He pointed his brush at me.
"But only after I have been compensated."
I nodded. "Agreed." His eyes narrowed.
"Any tricks, and our deal is off."
"Understood." I stretched out my hand toward him. "Shall we shake on it?" He laughed then, an amused, sharp noise that let him indulge in his triumph over the helpless American girl. And I had wanted to give him that before I did what I had to next. His hand felt rough in my own, but I clasped it and shook, as if I had lost, as if he had won, as if the gesture was an acknowledgement of defeat. Later, out in the streets, I had laughed, marveling that I had once ever doubted his worth. I waited until Maud had convinced her niece to rest, until she had tucked her into bed, as though a child, and emerged a short time later looking troubled and worn. "You were right," she said. her body sinking into the fabric of the sofa. I sat beside her. Thank you for telephoning me, Sophie, for letting me know what has been happening. I'm afraid Alice has always been prone to such episodes. She reached out, placing her hand on top of my own. Her touch was dry, cold, as if she were immune even to the heat of the desert, as if not even the elements of nature could threaten to overwhelm her. She was implacable, unmovable. She was, I could not help but think, a woman wasted on a girl like Alice. I imagined what I might have been, the things I might have accomplished, had fate chosen to bestow upon me a relation such as the woman in front of me. I quickly pushed the thought aside. Of course. I'll confess, I had hoped that John was just off with his friends on a silly little adventure of some sort. It wouldn't have been surprising, knowing him. She fixed her gaze on me. You were here when he went missing. What do you think happened? I considered my words carefully before I responded, casting aside those pieces of information that did not serve a purpose here. I don't know. They seemed fine at first, but then it started to become apparent that something was wrong. And then Alice confided in me about the other woman. I shook my head. The last time I saw John, they had a terrible fight. I don't know what happened after that. I just don't know. I whispered, forcing all the emotion I could into those final words so that they sounded ominous, haunting, so that both of us could feel them refusing to disappear. She nodded. The question now, I suppose, is what should be done? I affected surprise. With Alice, you mean? Yes. She sighed. I confess I've never really known what to do when it comes to Alice, what the right thing is. She's rather like my brother in that respect. I never knew what to say to him either. She shook her head, a shadow sweeping across her features. It all seems too much, in a way, that such misfortune should fall upon one girl so many times. First her parents, and then that boy in Vermont, now this. She shook her head. And this silly business with her old roommate. I don't understand it at all. She was adamant, you know, that the girl had something to do with the accident at Bennington, too. It took all my powers of persuasion to convince the police there that she was out of her mind, that she was just confusing it all. The accident, the girl's disappearance. I felt the weight of her words, of Alice's accusation deep within my stomach. Was it the police who suggested it to her? I asked, and seeing Maud's confusion, I continued on, unable to turn back. About her roommate, I mean. I imagine they could be rather forceful if necessary. Maud shook her head. No, this was Alice entirely. Why do you ask, dear? I blinked, my vision seeming suddenly hazy. Obscured, I thought. But then, no. I shook my head, the fluttering in my ears strong and persistent. Unrelenting, I decided. It just sounds so fantastical, I said quickly. So unbelievable, almost like... I paused, casting my eyes downward. Forgive me for asking Miss Shipley, but has Alice ever been committed? Maud's eyes cut to mine, hard, hesitant. No. Why do you ask? She seems so... fragile. And you mentioned about the episodes. I shifted, slightly. I know we weren't always the greatest of friends, but there was always something that seemed rather delicate about her. I continued, thinking back to the day I met her, letting the words become truth. I worried for her, about her. I paused. I had an aunt who was in quite poor health. She used to claim things that weren't really true, that someone had come into her house and touched her lamps, that someone had moved her furniture. My parents, they decided in the end that it was kinder to put her someplace where she could be looked after. Maud watched me now, her eyes sharp, missing nothing. I had considered it, she said, breaking the silence. After her parents died, she was inconsolable, you know, beyond normal grieving. She glanced at me, hurried and